Thank you for tuning in to the Joint Discussions. This is a growing coalition of information for a community built on all things cannabis. We are curating dialogue between various people throughout the cannabis supply chain to broaden access and to bridge the gap between cultivators, clinical providers, and connoisseurs to unite our community. And now, your host, Dr. Pepper Hernandez.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today at Humboldt Joint Discussions. We are here with a good friend of mine, Gregory DiBiago, and he is with Guardian of the Lost Terps, the Land Race Bureau. I've been having him with the whole Cannabis Holistic Institute, having discussions over there to educate the students on choosing cultivars. And I am super grateful as a land race cannabis enthusiast as you are, that we share that passion. And I'm glad that you've taken time to be with us today. You're in what, Southern Sunny California?
We're in sunny San Jose over here.
Oh, nice. It looks beautiful. Yeah, it looks great.
The Bay Area definitely spoils us here with beautiful weather.
So tell me, Gregory, what is your stance and your platform, and why have you dedicated your whole entire life to genetics and not just, you know, all land race genetics, but you're very specific on the Siberian genetics, but also, you know, like what made you go in that direction? Can you give us a little background on your history?
You know, I was born in Kazakhstan, and I was born in Kazakhstan, Almaty, which is really close to China and Kyrgyzstan and the Chuya Valley in Kazakhstan. And I think I was just really inspired by a couple of the folk stories that I read when I was growing up about this magical cannabis valley. And I think about the dreamy, romantic intoxication that was told about it. So I think that was kind of primarily what led me down, because I was really fascinated with my culture. I moved to the States like in 98. And since then, I've just been trying to learn more about the history, and my body just has a natural affinity with cannabis. I like it. It likes me. So I'm hugely inspired and curious about people's relationship with cannabis over history and time, because I think it is, and from my understanding, it is one of the fundamental plant species and crops that has been the cornerstone of civilizational progress. Like if we were to go back, you know, at the earliest known beginning of domestication, like 13,000 years ago in like Asia, and for the last 6,000 years, development of civilization in Asia, then we can absolutely see, it's very evident that cannabis has been one of the cornerstones for progress in civilization, because it is a cash crop. It has so many utilities and benefits, and it is medicinal. So I think those things really just kind of really inspire me to want to pursue more and to want to advance and experiment with the technology of breeding, with breeding science, molecular breeding, and developing cannabis into more uses because of its antibacterial properties, its anti-heat resistant properties, and just all the benefits that 100 years ago we really benefited all around the world with. And right now, China is the biggest producer of cannabis and cannabis products in the world. And I think their economic progress is an indication of its uses. And I think here, there might be some special interests that might actually be hindering our economic progress with the use of cannabis on a national level and international level.
So for those listeners who are new to land race cultivars specifically, can you describe what that means, why they're important, how we come to find those in the cannabis world?
Oh, so from my understanding, and I was just reading up on this a little bit this morning, cannabis can be classified in different categories. One of the ways that I found is very helpful to understand amongst the other ways that you could look at it is that it could be divided into wild resources, like local varieties, selective varieties, strains, and genetic material. So I think land races would, in a lot of sense, be able to fall into a lot of those categories simultaneously, like wild resources or local varieties or selective varieties, strains or genetic material. The purity of the land race term, I think, can also be debated, but in the way that I use and the way that I define it is land race variety is a variety that has been grown without assistance or human input for a variety prolonged period of time that has a sustaining population of 1,000 or more plants and sustains it and has sustained itself without human input for a very long time. And in that definition, I think a land race can still be classified if it was a feral land race or a domesticated land race. And I think it's important to make those distinctions, you know, when we're trying to talk about in detail about certain varieties or its benefits or its properties.
Thank you for that. So landrace strains are varieties of cannabis that grow in the wild with no interference from humans, is what I'm hearing you say, and that cultivars can be considered native to certain regions of the world. And I really want you to talk about the different regions that you're familiar with and like those cultivars that come from that, because landrace cultivars are really the backbone to the heirloom cultivation that, you know, I'm so familiar with in Humboldt, right? And so tell us a little bit about certain portions or regions of the world where maybe these cultivars or these landrace cultivars come from.
So, from all understanding and research, cannabis has originated and has been proliferating all around the world for a very long time. You could find varieties that are indigenous to Japan, South Korea, places that you have never would have thought before, even Australia. So cannabis has been all around the world. In certain places, it has been extremely eradicated. And in certain places, the geography is so vast and the topography is so extreme that it has been impossible to eradicate it regardless of the means. For instance, in Kazakhstan, there is a place called Chuva Valley. At one point in time, it was the largest natural cannabis valley in the world. It could be seen from space. And at one point in time, around the 1950s, the USSR decided to eradicate as much of it as possible. So they came up with technologies and diseases, and they sent airplanes out there to fumigate and to spray them. And one of the things that they used was actually derived from some of the plants in that region. There are really interesting pathogens and diseases, as well as benefits associated with these wild varieties from the Chuva Valley. And there's actually been quite a bit of research done in it, as you can imagine, since it has been one of the largest, probably biodiverse cannabis regions in the world. And I say that because there has been a lot of people who have done a lot of research since, you know, probably at all time, it's always been done because it's always been valuable and used as a tool. And I think it has a lot of financial benefit to use cannabis in a particular way in illicit markets, as well as regulated national strategic purposes. Because I think cannabis, in a lot of sense, by the Chinese government and by certain countries like the US, has been identified as a strategic plant species that has the power to shape civilizations in the way that it has in the past before.
Thank you for that. My next question for you is one that I'm always fascinated with. I'm wondering about the different genetics in Landrace cultivars that are unique to other parts of the world that we grow. So, for example, can you give us some names of ones that we want to go and look for, we want to go and focus on as a holistic health practitioner and naturopath and a cannabis therapy consultant? Some of my favorite are like Northern Lights and like the Kushes. Like I know Derby and Poison, that's like an African Landrace cultivar. And the Kushes typically are like a Pakistan, am I correct in saying that? In Western India. So can you give us a list of a few that maybe your favorite and ones that we could like look more into?
I definitely recommend that you guys look specifically first into the region where you're growing at, just so you can set the right expectations, because I still encourage anybody to grow. Just be mindful that if you're growing somewhere in Michigan, some Indian Landrace sativas might not do as well for you as you would want. So if you're growing somewhere in the northern regions, you'd want to focus on short flowering indica varieties. And I would definitely recommend that you guys look into the Pakistani Landrace Exchange Full Power Selections, the guys at Arising, because they have a plethora of new selections, last year's selections, and the previous 3-4 years. There, we have varieties that are very specific to the regions that they're coming from and to the farmers that they're coming from. Now, when we say like Pakistani or like Chitmel, Pakistani Chitmel Kush, see, that comes from a particular state and region within Pakistan, and it's still very difficult to know exactly or to identify it with that specific region, particularly because even within that region, there's a variety of Landrace varieties of the Pakistani Landraces within that region. So really, I think having to come to terms with this understanding, you really understand that whenever we say these Pakistani Landraces, we mean a general broad term for specific varieties from that region. For instance, there has been some feral varieties that are very useful for breeding purposes that come from the Tara Valley in Pakistan, and that is connected to the Hindu Kush. So in those wild populations, there's a lot of Hindu Kush varieties as well as feral Pakistani varieties of all different sorts, ranging from the most feral north, narrow leaf dominant varieties to very heavy indica to very heavy sedative short flowering varieties. And I would say if you guys wanted to check out something and you're growing somewhere in the western part of the states or even in Virginia in the East Coast, it's a very versatile variety in terms of its ability to do well here in the U.S. compared to the harsh environment that it came from. And you would be able to find some really true primordial examples of the strains that we see today in the modern cultivars. And it's very fascinating to explore those and to compare them side by side, because you will notice that there is small little differences and sometimes there are very drastic differences between the speed of growth, its sensitivity, you know, to indoor environment, to artificial environments, and to your control of the environment. You know, in nature, it has the ability to kind of really have a lot of signals and indications to let the plant know how to act ahead of time because of the biodiversity and biology in the soil communicating with the plant about the external and atmospheric conditions that are happening and that are approaching and the pattern of which it is happening and approaching. But inside your indoor grow space, you really don't have that ability for plant intelligence to be able to communicate and to know what's happening. So modern varieties are pretty much adapted to your indoor schedule and how you have been growing and how you would want to be growing according to a formula or to a recipe. But these Landrace varieties, they don't have that same understanding and that adaptability. So you will see that you have to be quite an adept student and to be able to provide what the plant needs initially and to be able to anticipate its needs So growing outdoors is a lot of times preferably because nature can just fire its engine and let the plant do its thing naturally.
I love that you share that. It's incredibly important that we do have our listeners understand that, you know, there are, from my understanding, there are over 30 like really strong cannabis land rice strains across the globe. And most of those are coming from South Asia, Middle, Central, South America, and, you know, the continent of Africa. And when we're trying to grow it here in the U.S. indoors, it's may not be the best place for that particular flower to express its all of its beauty. Another reason, and Greg, you and I both agree that outdoor is like the jam. And the reason why to grow outdoors, if you can in the state, and if you can't, you need to be a huge, strong advocate for being able to just have rights to your medicine, for God's sakes, right?
If you want to see those changes, you do have to be an advocate.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, 100%. But I liked where you were going, and this is also something we teach over at the Cannabis Holistic Institute, is choosing your cultivars or your strains for your location and your grow zone. And so what are you seeing a lot of people, because you're originally from the Ukraine, you've traveled around, right now you're in Southern California with your family. But like, what are you seeing a lot of people in different regions of the U.S.? What are they coming to you for? What cultivars are they trying to hunt down? Are they focused on how to grow it and where to grow it? Or is it more the name of those cultivars that they're looking for? Because I'm doing both. But what are you seeing in North America in your people that are coming to you?
Well, in particular, I could tell you that a lot of people understand that my focus and intention is really genetic preservation and conservation of genetic material. And I think that's what mainly people come to me for, because I, in my modeling on my mentors and the people who have inspired me most, have found that I, most of all, desire to be a breeder of breeders. And usually those people have to be able to have access to fundamental building blocks of all cannabis strains in different categories and regions. You are absolutely right to indicate that the strongest THC varieties are from Southern Asia and from Africa, from my understanding, because of their extremely potent THC content. And those are the sativa long flowering varieties that have a flowering period of between 11 and 16 weeks, 11 and 13 weeks, you know, 13 weeks kind of being an average for a true landrace sativa that has an opportunity to have extremely high levels of THC and THCV. Now, the varieties that are found in the northern regions, say southern Russia and northern Kazakhstan, those varieties have a very interesting utility and benefit for medicinal purposes for their particularly high ratios of THC and CBD, THCV and CBDV and CBDG. Now, it does not have as high of CBDG varieties as some of the analysis that we have access to from, say, the Pakistani and the Afghani landrace varieties, but they have high ratios of them in combination with CBD and THC. Now, the ratios and the percentages CBD and THC in plant is also different, because, for instance, to have a 1-to-1 THC to CBD is not naturally occurring, in my understanding. So to be able to achieve these naturally occurring ratios inside like cannabis plants is something very special for pharmacological purposes. And so those northern varieties, out of flowering, day neutral automatic varieties have interesting characteristics, because the regions we're talking about in large is called Bashkirstan. So Bashkirstan is an autonomous region. That's where most people imagine Siberia to be. So Siberia is basically kind of like in the middle, and then you have Moscow, the western part of Russia, and then you have the far east of Russia, right? So this middle region is actually separated by a huge mountain range called the Ural Mountain Range. So the Ural Mountain Range kind of separates the western part of Russia with the eastern part of Russia. And this little area is kind of called the Gate to Siberia because it actually is like an opening to the rest of eastern Russia. And it's very particularly interested, and I cannot profess to know very much, or I am not certain in the accuracy of my information. But what I can tell is that from the beginning of my chronological understanding is in the 19th century, in that part of the region, in Altai Russia, there was one of the hugest booms of cannabis breeding in the world. And at this point in time, cannabis was brought from all over the world for the purposes of breeding and making these incredible powerhouse machines for the turning of wheels of economy, industry, military complex, textiles, and everything else that comes with it. Because in all honesty, 100 years ago, the Navy was one of the strongest arms of the military a nation was able to possess. At that point in time, hemp and fiber and stems was one of the most sought after things. And if you did not have access to it, you were not able to have a Navy and you were not able to be a powerful nation in the world. And that's why England and, you know, all those countries that really participated in colonization had strong understanding and cannabis resources, because if they did not, they were not able to power their conquests. So from that understanding, I know that the cannabis that is now indigenous in these certain areas that we find may not have been indigenous there 100 years ago, but it may have been brought into there. We did not know unless we do genetic testing and have access to huge databases of the information gathered before, if it is indigenous or if these plots were actually some escape populations. But we do know that they have so many similarities and genetic markers that are identified as Northern Asian ruderalis or Siberian ruderalis or Siberian hash plant varieties, because within those regions, what you will find is that there is one of the largest genetic diversities that you find. And you will find plants that are 2 to 4 feet tall, and then you will find plants that are 14 feet tall and exhibit extremely different leaf structures. So you will find varieties that look absolutely covered in resin and that have very narrow leaf dominant structures, very open branching, and a variety of structures, not just in a Christmas tree variety that you might have seen in the textbooks from 1970s about how ruderalis looks. A lot of stereotypes of mine and of general knowledge out there, I see instantly were shattered when I personally was out and looking and taking a detailed observation and analysis and making notes. I found that you could actually find some really incredibly potent, widely varieties that are really indicative of some hybridized hash plant varieties. And from understanding of talking to villagers and looking at records, there's no indication. And there's no indication in papers about anybody being caught or bringing any kind of genetic material into these places. And a lot of these places would absolutely have no reason in access. And some of these places are so remote, it's very hard to fathom. But it is a possibility. So considering that, all we can do is just go out there, study, document, and hope maybe in 10 years from now, we'll know more about that specific region. But to take it as a whole, it's impossible to say anything in general other than just wanting to sound nice and talk generally about like all of Russia or all of Siberia. No, a lot of these varieties and the history of the origin of these varieties is really just unknown and mysterious. But what you can know is authentic sources who can tell you about the last 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. And a lot of time we can trace that directly back with some of the historical movements and migrations that we have seen through those places. Now, it's very evident, like I said, there has been a lot of cannabis that has been brought in from, I think, all over the world into those regions because of the diversity of the populations that we see there. And we have sent in these varieties to Phylos at a point in time before Phylos was, you know, publicly discovered to have many other nefarious purposes behind what they were doing. But we really don't have any other access to being able to have anybody identified on a genetic level, like, well, where these fit in into the comparison of the world. But Phylos still has a very good gene library and like a little gene world about how strains are related to each other that if people haven't checked out, they should check out, because a lot of people have sent in all sorts of varieties and they do show all sorts of levels of, you know, THC, CBD. So they have all those things on there. And then they also do have a format in which they display the genetic differences. It might be good for people to take a look at that, because that's, in all honesty, the only true way that you could identify, in all honesty, some of these.
I love so much that you said. I wrote down about 15 questions. We don't have time for that today, unfortunately, but you and I can continue to work together and educate people, and just I having platforms for you to be available to pop on to educate the students and any listeners that are wanting to know. I do thank you for your time. I value your information. I love this world that you are allowing the cannabis enthusiasts to like join. So I appreciate that. Before we take off for the hour, I would love to know, if someone was interested in Landrace cannabis genetics and they're wanting to get into preservation like you are, where do they start? Where do they start by learning just a little bit about what makes Landrace cannabis so, so valuable and so important?
I think one of the most important things would probably, as a starting place, would to start on my Instagram page to message and reach out to me. I have readily available 10 to 5 names that will blow anybody's minds away, who are the cornerstones of all cannabis genetics in the world. I mean, I'm here representing Northern Russia and some of the Central Asia. We have our homies Landrace Mafia, Trident Seeds, and our homies Pakistani Landrace Exchange, Arising, representing and holding down the huge portion of the Pakistani and the Afghani land races. I would reach out to my homie Coco Jeans. He represents and has direct access to a lot and most of the Indian and Northern Himalayan varieties. And I would reach out to me, because I don't necessarily have them, their handles in my mind memorized. But I have access to all the homies who have the South Asian Thai strains. So I would really just reach out to me, because I also have friends in Africa, and we could connect you guys directly to people in Kenya and in the Swazi regions. And in the future, I'm hoping to have all this information on my website and to really also do my part in being able to give back people's access to the resources that should be public, because these are incredibly trusted, wholehearted, warm individuals who, you know, are just passionate and driven intrinsically to see benefits people are able to get for themselves from this.
And again, you're Greg at Guardian of the Lost Terps, website being landracebureau.com. How else can we reach out to you? Is that your major spaces? I know you're on all the social medias, but anything else that you want to share with our listening audience?
Guys, go give my Instagram page some love. That's really my primary source to be in contact with all my main people. That's where I've been developing my networks heavily since 2016. And that's where most of the people who are need to know are at for me.
Well, Gregory, I hope that you come up and visit Humboldt sometime soon. I don't know how long you're going to be in California, but you're welcome to come up and visit and meet some amazing organic sun-grown farmer friends of mine. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for taking time to be present with us today. And you listeners, thank you for listening. Enjoy your day, and let's make this your very best life ever.